Barclays are the biggest funders of fossil fuels in Europe.
HSBC have invested £80 billion in the last 5 years.
They are selling our future, and people in the global south are suffering now.
They're killing us, but they're trying to convince us that they're not.
I just want to bring you some pictures that we're getting from Canary Wharf in East London, where Extinction Rebellion climate protesters have gathered and were responsible for shattering at least 19 windows at one of the towers there, this one, the HSBC headquarters.
The harm of a broken window pales in comparison to the harm these companies are doing to us,
our children and our grandchildren.
This is only about a week or so ago that actually Extinction Rebellion broke windows on the Barclays Bank building.
Courage calls to courage everywhere.
Hi and welcome back to another episode of News from a World in Flux. I'm Charlie Gardner. I'm a conservation scientist and member of Scientists for Extinction Rebellion, and I'm with Claire Farrell, who's a co-founder of Extinction Rebellion here in the UK. We've got quite a special episode today. Normally, we are speaking about big news in the world of climate and climate activism. And today, we're speaking about news that one of us has particular experience of. In fact, Claire is right at the heart of it. So 2.5 years ago, Claire was one of 9 women that carried out an action at HSBC Bank, and they broke the windows. And for the last 2.5 years, they've been living under the threat of a potential jail sentence as a result of this. But last month in November, they were found not guilty, and it's been fantastic news. So Claire, tell us about, I mean, you must be delighted by the news, obviously, but tell us about the action you did. Why did you decide to target HSBC Bank, and what did you do?
Yes, so we went to the bank with hammers and chisels that we'd painted with messages about peace and justice, and many of the women also had painted the names of female activists from South Africa, from a group called the Pink Panthers, who are, I guess, like a sort of eco-feminist group that particularly campaign on issues of climate that disproportionately affect women. So we painted up these hammers, and we had these stickers that we stuck on the windows that said $80 billion into fossil fuels in the last 5 years.
That's how much HSBC have invested in.
That was how much they invested in fossil fuels since the Paris Agreement, because that was on our sticker and it was at the scene of the action, so-called crime by the prosecutor. That meant that we could reference it all the time. So it was extremely valuable having that as like the core message, because it enabled us to then say, this is about the Paris Agreement. And then the jury, interestingly, several of the jury members asked questions throughout the trial, which is also not that usual. I think a lot of jury members often show up to a trial and they sort of accept what they're given and go away and do the work with the information that they've got, do their deliberation based on what they get sort of told to do in a top-down way. But actually, jurors can ask questions of defendants or lawyers, and they do it by putting their hand up and giving a piece of paper to the judge. There were several jury members who asked a lot of questions, and some of the questions were things like, can you explain what is the Paris Agreement? So all of that was super valuable that we did that. We had that sort of messaging with us on the day. Another thing that happened that day, we went to Canary Wharf really early in the morning to the headquarters. It's this immense building. It's actually the most expensive building that's ever been sold in Britain. It has almost got 5,000 windows. So we didn't break very many of them in that comparison. We went there and tapped on various bits of glass each, and then sat down on the floor. So it's quite a feel. It felt like probably the edge of my courage in a way. I felt very self-conscious about that because I did find it quite scary. But also equally, it's over very, very quickly. It really doesn't take very long to break a window. That's what we did. And I also taped a bundle of documentation to the building, which we had a bit of a legal fight in the courtroom about whether or not that could come into the room. I did that because I wanted to make clear why we were doing what we were doing, and it included a paper on the defence implications of the climate crisis for the UK that was commissioned by the Ministry of Defence, papers from Nature about tipping points, thinking a sort of working paper from the IMF about like macroeconomics and climate policy, and it basically said that state failure and, you know, policy failure and market failure together are sort of self-perpetuating dynamic that means that the climate crisis is never going to get sorted out because of the money. So I had all this stuff that like stuck to the building. And then we all sat down and sang songs.
Sounds like a really powerful thing to have been part of. Is there any reason why you... Why did you choose to break the windows rather than, say, gluing yourself to the building or blockading the entrance or doing something else with a different symbolism at that building?
Well, for me, it felt like the right thing to do for multiple reasons. And one of those was in the spirit of escalation, because, you know, we've all of us, lots of us have done a lot of these actions where you sort of get in the way, cause a disruption. There's something a bit more serious about breaking a window. It's not, you can't wash it off. It's like, no, I broke that. The fact that it comes from our political history and what I would see myself as in a tradition that comes from the Chartists who broke windows, who inspired the suffragettes to then do their breaking of windows. It was, you know, it was definitely something that we saw ourselves as part of a tradition, a political tradition of this country. But also as groups of women, and there are other people who are outstanding trials for basically doing the same thing at other times, at other banks. Most of these actions were initially carried out entirely by women. We organised that as well to, I guess by design, it would be easy to paint a group of men as breaking windows, as appearing to be more violent. It's, if you've got a diverse group of women, including grandmothers and university students and all people in between, it's a lot harder to say, look, that was a violent act. We did a lot to mitigate against it appearing violent because we believe that it is possible to damage property non-violently.
Yeah, and when you look at the images and the videos of that action and others, it's, you know, you couldn't do it in a more safe and ordered and calm way. And so, you know, the whole vibe of it is the very opposite of violence, and it really helps, you know, belie this myth that actually damage to property should count as violence, which, you know, of course it's not.
Yeah, and quite often that topic often comes up in courtrooms, and it didn't really come up that much in this case, actually, which I was surprised by. It came up when we were, so immediately after we did the action, we were held obviously in police custody, but when it got to the morning, we'd been held overnight, we'd been taken in for interview, and they arrested us for $200,000 of damage. Then when we went into an interview room, they told us it was $500,000, which I think a lot of us found quite shocking, actually, because I didn't get up that morning and think, yeah, I'm going to do $500,000 worth of damage today. I was completely staggered by the value of the windows, what they claimed. You know, one window was £30,000. And I was like, well, that's like more than I earn in a year.
It's too much money in the wrong things, isn't there? Blimey.
Fucking hell. Yeah. You know, we went through that process, and then in the morning they said, okay, we're going to send you to court. And I thought, oh God, they're going to try and remand us, which is what was happening.
In other words, remand means keeping you, banged up without having to...
Yeah. So
you stay inside until you go to court.
So put you in prison to await trial. And the prosecution on that day was this guy who, in my memory, he was like a sort of cartoon, like bad guy, like these big glasses and bald head. And he stood there in this magistrate's court and was like, this is a nine-handed mob of violent women. And he called us dangerous. And he said, like, who knows what they're capable of and all this stuff. And part of me, like, stood there thinking, like some of the best women ever have been like stood in a courtroom and been called dangerous.
Absolutely, yeah, you must have
but
been
also,
bad.
You know, this sort of implication that we were violent people, I think, you know, it felt really strong in that room, but that charge didn't really come at us as much as I'd expected in the Crown Court room, actually. So there wasn't that much deliberation between the kind of legal representatives and the judge about whether or not breaking property can be termed, to, you know, violent inherently. I think Gully, one of our co-defendants, she put it really beautifully in her closing remarks when she said, like, you know, we live in a world where panes of glass don't have feelings and they can't have grief and they can't mourn, but human beings do. And so it was, you know, it was an extremely emotional trial, actually. I mean, I guess all of our trials always are, but yeah, it was immensely emotional, a lot of tears, actually.
So we missed a bit in the story there. So you, they decided you weren't, they weren't going to hold you on remand.
We managed to get out.
But then there's 2.5 years until you're back at a Crown Court in front of a jury. So why did it take so long? And was there, how come you ended up in front of a jury? Because not all defendants always end up in front of a jury, do they? So
you get a jury trial if you do over a certain threshold of damage, which we were definitely over the threshold. I think often it's around, like, if you're under £5,000 of criminal damage, you're always going to go into magistrate's court. If you're over, I don't know where the threshold is, but, you know, say you go over 10, I think you're likely to get a jury. I'm not sure where the lines are. But our case was listed for last year, and it should have happened in, like, May 22. And then it got pulled 2 weeks before. Because the government had asked for an appeal on the Coulston statue case. And basically, the people who pulled down the Coulston statue in the Black Lives Matter protest in Bristol were acquitted by a jury. And they were acquitted by a jury partly using an argument, which is using the ECHR, European Charter of Human Rights, Articles 10 and 11. Article 10 is freedom of expression. I've used that argument before on cases where I say, you know, the reason why I put paint here is because I've got an Article 10 right to express myself, and these are very critical times, blah, blah, blah. So you make the argument about why you had to express yourself in that particular way at that time, and why you did you're supposed to say that you did the minimum that you possibly could to have the amount of impact that you needed to have, whatever it is.
And this was the argument that the Black Lives Matter protesters
Must have been the argument that they won on.
And they were found not guilty over
and
a
they were found
statue.
Not, yeah, they were found not guilty by jury. And they brought in an expert, the BBC presenter David Olasaga, to talk to the jury as an independent expert witness about their beliefs. So it's, if you have Article 10 as a defence, the jury don't have to believe you that what you say is correct, because you can bring in an expert that says what they say is actually true. And I'm independent, I'm not their friend. So ideal world, we would have had Article 10 on this case, and we could have brought in finance experts, climate scientists, I could have called you, you know, we could have brought people in. Having expert witnesses really strengthens your case, and it helps you to communicate with a jury because you have another trusted voice in the room. The establishment, like, lost their shit about Coulston, appealed the case, sent it up to the higher courts, and the appeal went against us. So basically our trial went on hold for more than a year because we were waiting for that outcome of that appeal in order that the judge would know how to run the case.
Sure.
And so when we got our trial date listed for this year, for November, we knew that we couldn't use Article 10 anymore. So we knew that we were on our own and not going to be able to bring in any experts. And it's just a way of, you know, the state moving the goalposts because they don't like it when they lose, basically.
So obviously people might be really concerned by what they're hearing about what's going on with our legal system. What can they do? What can people do to support and raise attention?
Well, there's a wonderful woman in our movement called Trudy Warner, who came to our trial actually quite a lot. It was really lovely to see her. And she started sitting outside a court where activists were being told they couldn't talk about climate or fuel poverty or any of the reasons why they were doing their actions. And she held up this sign, which had a statement on it, which is actually carved into stone in the Old Bailey, which is about how juries have an absolute ultimate right to make a judgment according to their conscience. And she sat outside the court holding this sign, saying this is juries can, you know, juries get directed by a judge what to do, but if they think, nah, they can defy the judge because they have an enshrined right in this country to be the legal backstop, a democratic backstop to the legal system. And she got arrested and put in a cell and told she was going to be charged with perverting the course of justice, which can carry a life sentence, I think, or something mad like that. And then that started a snowball of a campaign called Defend Our Juries, where people around the country have been joining Trudy to sit with their sign, and the numbers have gone up and up and up and up. And so people can join that campaign. They can go and look at what they're doing. Also, if you look on the press section of their website, there's a lot of really, really interesting opinion pieces, interviews that are coming from like experts in the legal profession who are saying this is fundamentally important because we're very lucky. We talked about it in my trial. Like, we are really lucky that when we go into a courtroom, it's a group of ordinary people who are not paid by the state, who don't have like vested interest in the status quo, who are like me and you, and that's who we have to like look in the eye in a courtroom and say, you know, you can find me not guilty, and you give your argument to them. It's really important. It's just a really important facet of how this country is structured, and this campaign has been, I think, quite successful so far in sort of raising awareness around that. And one of the experts who's written on it said, you know, it's really curious, isn't it, if you have a right that people don't want you to know that you have. So if you're holding a sign outside a courtroom that just states a piece of law on it and you can be arrested for that, well, you've got the whole system tying itself in knots. Do you know what I mean? So it's an extremely like well-designed and executed campaign, in my opinion, because it's also attracting quite a lot of support from across the spectrum. There's a lot of people on the conservative end or the right end of political space who will also say, this is super important. Of course, juries have a right to be independent. So, yeah, so people should look that up and go and join them.
Yeah, do. Like, you know, nothing is more important than the right to have access to justice. And it is, of course, so much bigger than just a climate issue. So yeah, support Defend Our Juries campaign. So I saw some pictures of you outside your Crown Court and you all look very snazzy. What was that about?
We were coming up to the trial and I mean, people know my background's fashion, but I was obviously thinking, oh God, what am I gonna wear? And I don't know, it just came into my mind, why don't you ask some ethical, sustainable designers that you know if they'll lend you some smart clothes, because it would be really nice for the women if we could all go in looking, feeling good, basically. A few years ago, Stella McCartney invited me and some others to go over to Paris to a press conference. And people may or may not know that she's been working on sustainability and stuff in fashion for a long time. And yeah, she just popped into my mind and I thought, oh, I wonder if Stella would lend us some nice stuff. So I reached out and she was like, yeah, totally. So we got a big whole load of stuff that came to my house, like coats, jackets, things. So we split them all up and broadly everyone had like a piece or a suit or something like that. And personally, I just found it really, I just found it a really good support because I felt like I looked sharp, you know.
You did.
And I always think there's something about, you know, the way that you get dressed that like changes the way that you feel. that can change the way that you then sort of hold yourself and the way that you behave and all of that. So I felt like it was really kind support from her to loan them to us, but it felt sort of like confidence giving in a strange kind of way.
Excellent. Well, what I really like about that is that obviously, you know, not everybody can risk arrest breaking windows at a bank. It takes a tremendous amount of courage, you know, a certain position of privilege and stuff. But people can support in other ways. And for a prominent, you know, well-known person to support like that, I think is really powerful because, you know, I think a lot of people sort of think that, you know, oh, climate change, that's an issue for environmentalists, right? And yeah, of course we expect to hear this message because they're environmentalists. That's what they talk about. But when you have someone that's not known as an environmentalist, and you know, they're speaking to whole new audiences, you know, yeah, fashion exactly. people that like Stella McCartney now get to hear this and we'll listen to it because you know, it's Stella McCartney support when they wouldn't have listened to you or Extinction Rebellion ever. So, and it just goes to show, you know, all right, we're not all famous designers, but we can all support and show our support in different ways. And I think it's important that we do if we can.
Yeah, and the support, I have to say, for the trial itself was at points just overwhelmingly brilliant. You know, the people in the movement, people who showed up, the people in my friendship circle even who are not part of the movement, who, you know, one of my friends was making me dinners and bringing them around, putting them in the fridge so that I didn't have to think about cooking food and stuff. You know, we had a lot of the women from outside of town came and all stayed in one house. They had to rent a house to live in together. And they had, you know, a support person who came down, Molly, and like lived in with them, and she cooked all the food. And when we got to lunch breaks, people would produce a whole box full of sandwiches and there was enough lunch for all nine of us. It was amazing. I felt like fantastically supported by people during the trial. People were totally brilliant. I'm really, really grateful.
So there's been a lot of jury trials of Extinction Rebellion activists, and there's been a range of different outcomes. I think it's about half-half.
Yeah.
Very roughly, have been found not guilty. Have you, having been through this process, have you got any thoughts about, you know, why is there such variation? Why do some juries find people not guilty and others don't?
Well, it's a good question. I think one thing about the justice system is that it's made of human beings and it means that it's extremely unpredictable, because if you get a random selection of 12 people, you might have more than half of them that are very socially conservative. You might have majority of them are quite progressive. You don't know because it's so random. So that's chance, massively. Then there's also fact that the law around a lot of these kinds of actions is you can read it in various different ways. So you can go into one courtroom with one judge who's going to play a really hard line. And actually, some people are on trial at the moment with a judge who I think is being extremely hard on them. Roger and Valerie and Larch are on trial right now as we speak. They're just waiting for the verdict today. Their judge has been tough. Our judge was actually quite generous in terms of what he let us talk about in the room. And obviously, if you've done something that falls under the new public nuisance law and you're a member of Just Stop Oil and you're on trial for public nuisance, it is possible to find yourself in a situation where the judge says you can't talk about the climate. Our case was just plain old criminal damage, and nothing about that set of law has changed because they didn't change the Criminal Damage Act in line with protest. They've changed the laws around public disruption. So we got lucky because the judge gave us room to speak and let us speak and allowed us to use three defences, which he then said he would review after evidence giving. So that's really good because it means you get to give lots of argumentation in front of the jury. So even if they do take those defences away from you later, the jury have heard all the argumentation. They've heard the arguments that hopefully have convinced them that what you were doing was, you know, justified, effective, helpful, selfless, like not for your own gain, you know, all the things that they need to be able to think about to be able to say, I think we should let these people off, you know. So, yeah, the rooms can be run in like totally different ways for cases that seem similar or the same. If you've got a different judge, you might have a different room, you might be playing a different game, different rules.
So this sounds like, you know, quite a significant thing and perhaps something that not everybody realises. You know, we think of jury trials as, you know, it coming down to the decisions of these 12 randomly selected men and women. It's just this fantastic idea, this sort of, you know, buffer against the power of the state that to just, you know, have monopoly rights to just bang anyone up. Like, so ordinary people have some power against this. But it's not just the level playing field that we might assume it is, because actually the judge is massively important here. Like, the judge can just determine what they decide the juries hear and don't hear. And of course, the judge is not a random person. It's someone, it's an appointee that presumably other people give them directions, tell them you know, what
so
to
the
do.
Higher courts can tell them what to do. Government legislation can tell them what to do. But they also themselves sit in a position of like immense kind of power on their elevated bench at the back of the room. I mean, it is it's a weird game, you know. It's and there's something that's actually extremely unpleasant about the experience of being in court with your own life hanging in the balance and going, fuck, this is just a game. Like, people wear these weird wigs and these weird outfits, and actually, like, you look normal and the jury look normal. Everyone else looks super weird because they're like swooshing around in all these weird outfits. The jury don't get to see the whole trial because they get the show put on for them. They come in, they witness the bit they're allowed to witness, and then they leave the room. They don't see how much the prosecution and the defense lawyers are constantly trying to trip each other up or trying to get one over on each other, you know. And there were points in our trial where, you know, I just felt like the prosecution was, you know, trying to get one up on you by refusing to allow certain bits of evidence in. So the two sides, the defence and the prosecution, are supposed to agree on what's allowed into the room, what's going into people's defences, what evidence the jury get to look at, that kind of thing. They're supposed to agree it and then say, hi, judge, we've agreed this. But if they can't agree on something, then they fight over it and eventually it gets given to the judge to deal with and then they make a ruling on it. So that happened with various things like the bundle of evidence I take to the building. We said that's evidence from the scene because it's a criminal trial. And the prosecution said, no, it's irrelevant. Mm. And I was like, but I took it with me. And I actually took, it was like a sort of totemic kind of object that I would bring into court with me every day, even though it was like pointless, but I just had to have it with me. I had it all printed out again and I smack it on the table in front of me. And it was like the evidence that was with me the whole time, all these papers. But they didn't want it in the room because it basically gave you all of the expert information that is the backbone of a necessity argument that says, of course, there's a necessity for action here. They don't want that in the room in front of the jury. So they were like, no, you can't have that. And then in the end, they said you can have a summary that describes each of the papers, which we produced. And then they had the arse about it and said, well, we don't know who wrote the summary. And it's like, well, if you want a summary, someone's going to write the fucking summary. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it was all this like pointless tussling. And then eventually just going, we can't agree. We've spent like a fucking day on it. And then you send it up to the judge. And then the judge says, well, they can have the title of each paper and like a single sentence that says what's in it, which is not a summary. You know what I mean? So you end up getting like a worse deal because the prosecution fight and fight and fight and fight and delay and delay and delay. And that's just a game. That's just tactics.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there going, wow, this is my life at stake in this weird game of these.
Your real lives and you know, the bigger issues, the reason we're all here in the first place, you know, the lives of millions of people.
Yeah.
Just abstract and yeah. Not part of the deal at all. So it sounds like you got a judge that allowed you certain defences and allowed you, each of you, I believe, to speak to the juries. Mm. Other climate activists recently have been banned by their judges. There's one judge in particular that's developing quite a reputation, known by Silas Reid, and he's been preventing defendants from mentioning climate change in their defences. When it was Insulate Britain defendants, he banned them from also mentioning insulation or fuel poverty of things. And it's been fundamentally shocking to a lot of people that activists will go to trial and not be allowed to share their motivations, their defences, because it just feels an integral part of the justice system. How can it even pretend to be justice if you're not allowed to share your motivations? The legal landscape in the UK seems to be changing quite fast.
Yeah.
A common interpretation of that is that the jury trials are embarrassing for the state when activists get found not guilty. So the government tries to change the legal landscape, so that's less likely to happen. How do you think your trial fits into this, these broader changes in the UK landscape? And what should people be aware of in all these changes? Because at the moment, it feels like climate activists are broadly aware of these incredible changes to the legal system in the UK. But these changes are obviously much bigger than just climate protests. They affect all our rights. And yet people outside the climate bubble don't seem to really be talking about it. So tell us a bit about the bigger issues.
Well, I think most people are broadly unaware of what's happened to the country in the last year or so in terms of the restrictions, the right to protest, the right to express yourself. There's definitely been there's a clear intention from the state that this is supposed to have a chilling effect on dissent. It's supposed to shut people up. It's supposed to stop people from being brave enough to go out and do this stuff in the first place. And of course, there are groups like Just Stop Oil going out and just in defiance of it, doing it and doing it and doing it anyway. And just this morning, I got a press release sent to me that someone's just been given a 6-month sentence for slow marching down the street. 6 months inside, not suspended, gone inside for that. And, Morgan's just come out this week from 14-month stretch for a very successful road closure. I mean, it's like people around the world are looking at this country going, what the fuck are you doing? They really are. Mm. And I think the general public don't actually understand the severity of the restrictions that have been put on because the court system is so clogged up. I mean, it took us 2.5 years to have a trial. There are other people on trial at the moment who, for things that happened in 2019, probably there's stuff stretching back longer. I've been coining the term, we live in a Tory failed state. So it's like, the NHS is really, really, really suffering and struggling to stay alive. The schools are literally falling down. The court system is clogged and like fucked up. And realistically, like any sane person in this current context would not say like it's a priority to put non-violent protesters in our already overflowing jails they're not banging up bent coppers, they're not banging up rapists, they're not, it's like, I don't see how you can make it a priority that somebody who won't stop walking down the middle of a road in a high-vis jacket, I don't see how you can like say they're a priority, put them away because they're very, very annoying. It's like, so I think because of the time delay on how long it takes to go to trial, we're also, we're not seeing people being sentenced quickly. So that's also affects the public perception of the laws, because if you don't see the implications of those laws because they're not being played out very much yet, that also means there's a delay on people hear the news about the legislation and go, oh, that sounds a bit bad. And then if you're not going to see people getting like sentenced off it for a year or more, there's a big disconnect, I think, for people not to understand the severity of what's been put on offer for the state to use against people. And of course, we talked about this in a previous episode about how, you know, this legislation was written by think tanks that are funded by oil.
Policy Exchange,
This is legislation that was dreamt up because Extinction Rebellion was effective. It's been bought and paid for by international fossil fuel interests, in my opinion. You know,
Rishi Sunak explicitly thanked Policy Exchange for having drafted the legislation. Yeah. And we know Policy Exchange gets their money from fossil fuel interests.
Yeah. You know, I think for this case, it's obviously I feel great about the fact that I'm not going to jail and that I had that hanging over me for 2.5 years. And I know that we all feel obviously relieved. But there's also, for me, something important about like now being able to go out and talk about it, not just to say like, you know, it's possible to do something like that and for a jury to acquit you, but what a damning indictment of our circumstances. Because if 12 random ordinary people can be convinced that it's like legit to do £500,000 of damage to a bank because of their business practices, well, that is extraordinary because their business practices are so fucked that ordinary group of people think that's fair enough. And I'm not like someone who found that an easy thing to do. I'm not, you get a sort of identity in this movement, I think, as being like a rebel and a rule breaker and blah, blah, blah. I didn't find it easy to break a window. I didn't want to. I didn't find it easy at all. It was like the most stressful, like terrible thing that I've ever done. I felt like really worried about it and really worried that it was too scary for me to do, even though we made it as like soft and safe and nice and everything as possible. But for a group of ordinary people who are not me, who are not like radically minded and thinking about how to get change to happen quickly on climate, to be able to talk to them in a room where the rules are pinned down by the establishment, where you're very restricted in like your operational space that you get in the court, to be able to win on their terms, playing their rules in that room, it really means the situation is like fucking nuts, because that, you know what I mean?
So it's really extraordinary.
That's like, what I think's amazing about it.
It shows just what an utter failure all the systems we're supposed to trust to keep us safe have been.
Yeah.
That a jury were able to say, yeah, that, what you did is justified.
Yeah.
Because everything else that you could have done just doesn't work. So I think it's, you know, it's as much as I can't even begin to understand the stress and the fear that action caused you. It must be really validating and empowering to have been told that you were right, as extreme and unlikely as that action was. You were right to do it, and that's an amazing thing. It's a really uplifting victory. So thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about that. I'm sure everyone can extend their thanks and respect to Claire and her 8 co-defendants for the action they've taken on our behalf and on behalf of All Life. And join us soon for another episode where we'll be talking about some other recent goings on in the world of climate breakdown and our efforts to avoid it.